This is the Publix Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. A New Bedford man who spent weeks in an ICE detention center is out. He could pursue legal action for wrongful detainment. We'll get an update on the story. Also, community health workers provide a unique service that advocates say is vital to keeping healthcare costs down. Rhode Island lawmakers are considering a bill that forces private insurers to cover many of the services provided by these workers. And Leo's Bar was an institution in Providence. For Artscape, we look back on how the bar and its owner, John Rector, were so important to so many people. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. This week, a New Bedford man was reunited with his family after being detained by ICE and spending a month at a corrections facility in New Hampshire. Advocates for the man, Juan Francisco Mendez, remain outraged by the aggressive tactics federal agents used to detain him and the fact that he was held without charges for weeks. His attorney says her client may file a lawsuit in the future. Here to talk with us about the details of the case is the Publix Radio and Community Engagement reporter, Paul C. Kelly Campos. Paul, always a pleasure.
Pleasure to be here, Luis.
Paul, remind us what happened here and why it's gotten so much attention.
Juan Francisco Mendez and his wife, Marilu Domingo Ortiz, were on the way to a dentist appointment. A couple unmarked vehicles in front of them stopped their path. Some immigration agents came out. We're asking them questions. We're looking for a man named Antonio. He's not named Antonio. His name is Juan Francisco. His wife, whom I've spoken to multiple times, says that she did not see a judicial warrant. They were asking them to get out of the vehicle, despite them showing pieces of identification that show that, you know, neither of them are named Antonio. So they called their immigration lawyer, Ondine Galvez Sniffen, who advised them not to comply with anything until she was there, you know, to kind of help them sort that out. So they waited for her, let the ICE agents know in Spanish that they were waiting for their attorney. And they waited for about 30 minutes inside the car, Marilu, his wife, recording everything, until after about 30 minutes, the agents used what looked like a large iron axe to break through the rear window of the car and forcibly pull them both out and detaining him and taking him to New Hampshire.
Paul, what did ICE say this guy did wrong?
So I've tried on several occasions to reach out to ICE, you know, via calling them or leaving them emails or what have you for their regional office. But they don't get back to me, unfortunately. But I did see that the New Bedford Light had heard from a spokesperson of theirs who said that their reason for detaining Juan Francisco is, quote, he is an illegally present Guatemalan alien who refused to comply with officers' instructions and resisted apprehension. So that's the reason that they gave the New Bedford Light, at least.
He was released from the Stratford County Department of Corrections in New Hampshire on Thursday. But how did that come about?
From what I understand from his lawyer, Ondine Galvez Sniffen, the reason for his release was that he had been, you know, in custody for close to a month with no formal charging documents correctly filed to the court. They were last Tuesday, as I mentioned, but a judge issued for his immediate release on a bail of $1,500.
Yeah, and he's released on bond. So what does that mean? Is the case over?
There's still, I think, one more hearing that he needs to go through before he's 100% out of the clear, a virtual hearing to see if there's still any basis to remove him from the country and whatnot. And speaking of that bond, his lawyer did mention to me that she had initially argued to have his bond be set at zero because she was arguing that the way and manner that he was arrested was illegal. But the minimum, you know, bond was $1,500. So that was the lowest he could have possibly got in terms of bond.
Juan Francisco has a wife and son. How's this affected them?
Oh, hugely. She's been telling me that she cannot sleep. I interviewed her for a feature story a couple weeks ago, but she was telling me, I can't sleep. I can't rest. I can't do anything. She, her husband was the primary breadwinner. You know, he was paying for their rent and whatnot. From what she told me, she's stacked up quite an amount of legal fees. You know, outside of having to pay for rent and take care of their 9-year-old son who has, you know, also been going through this. You know, where's my dad? I'm not going to eat until my dad's here. Not wanting to go to school because of being worried about his mother might be gone. So it's been really affecting them, not just financially, but like very, very much emotionally.
What's next for Juan Francisco Mendez?
He still needs to attend another virtual hearing before his case is fully resolved. And his lawyer, Ondine Galvez-Sniffen, was mentioning to me that once he's had some time to, you know, decompress, spend some time with his family, which I think I would understand is his main priority, to spend time with his family after being away for so long, she hopes to discuss the possibility of pursuing a civil lawsuit for violation of his constitutional rights. But at the same time, you know, she wants to follow his lead if that's something he wants to do, you know, because he's still, you know, is in process of getting his own asylum status approved through his wife. So if that's something that he thinks would benefit him and his family, she will, you know, chat with him about that.
Paul C. Calicampos, community engagement reporter for the Publix Radio. I really appreciate the insight. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis.
Our political reporter, Ian Donis, joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, always a pleasure.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
You sat down this week with U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse for an interview airing this Sunday on Rhode Island PBS Weekly. How does he see the way forward for Democrats in the new age of President Trump?
Well, he thinks Democrats have fallen into the trap of getting caricatured by Republicans on single issues. He thinks they have to make a more populist argument on the economy and talk about issues like the Supreme Court and anonymous campaign contributions from corporations. My interview will also air Monday on the Publix Radio, and Whitehouse is looking to the midterm elections next year when voters might be able to send a message to the White House about what they think about Donald Trump and his approach.
Governor Dan McKee has outlined the findings of a cyber breach into the state's online portal for health and human services. What are some of the key findings?
One of the biggest ones is that Deloitte, the state's contractor, was unaware of what was happening for months. The discovery of the cyber breach last year came about 5 months after the intrusion was first made, and hundreds of thousands of Rhode Islanders were affected, including some not previously recognized as affected. The state is going to be getting in touch with those people to let them know that they have options like freezing their credit and taking other steps to ensure their data security. But the state is looking to take some kind of action against Deloitte. The case is being referred to Attorney General Peter Norona, so we have not heard the last of this.
And finally, the General Assembly session heading toward the home stretch. How will the change in leadership address what happens in the legislature?
Well, the change you were referring to is how Val Lawson, instead of Dominic Ruggiero, is now president of the state Senate. She is more liberal than Ruggiero was, and that could produce a different result on some issues, although it remains to be seen. A couple of the high-profile bills include a proposed ban on new sales of so-called assault weapons, a proposal to increase taxes on the richest 1% of Rhode Islanders, and an attempt to cap what payday lenders charge in interest. But we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Ian, it's always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column out every Friday at 4 p.m. We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch in just a moment. This is the Publix Radio. I'm Lewis Hernandez. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. Community health workers in Rhode Island play a critical role in connecting people with a variety of healthcare resources, ranging from counseling to health screenings. But the services they provide are often not covered by commercial insurers. And because of that, many Rhode Islanders can't afford those services, and organizations that employ community health workers struggle to pay their salaries. State lawmakers are considering a bill supporters say would address those challenges by requiring insurance companies to cover the services community health workers provide. Here to talk more about the proposed legislation is Susan Orban, board director of the Washington County Coalition for Children. Susan, thanks so much for the time.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with this. What is a community health worker? What do they do?
Sure. So community health workers are trained members of the community who connect people with the services that they need, and they have a deep understanding of the community. And so they know who to go to, how to help people navigate the barriers and so forth, and can be extremely helpful with patients that face great challenges. So those with chronic diseases, those facing financial struggles, those maybe new to the area that need connected to the healthcare system. Community health workers work in a variety of settings in Rhode Island. They work as part of Meals on Wheels. They work in hospitals. They work in community health centers, playing a very vital role.
All right. Give me a sense of when I might call a community health worker or seek one out compared to if I'm just reaching out to a doctor or any other health worker.
Yeah, usually community health workers have some affiliation with some organization and they're part of a team, and that's how they get connected with patients. The doctor or the counselor or case manager recognizes that this person really needs help filling out an application or could benefit from a diabetes education class, and so makes the referral to a community health worker.
Why don't commercial insurers in Rhode Island cover the services provided by community health workers?
While community health workers have been around and been called a lot of different names over the years, it's just recently been professionalized and in a way that is able to be reimbursed. So because in the health system, services are billed by what services are provided in that moment. You get an x-ray, there's a bill for that. And there hasn't been that kind of system to bill for community health workers typically. And often organizations would pay for these services of community health workers either through grant dollars or through fundraising. And when times get tight, they're the first thing that is cut. Then community health workers are laid off, and many have been laid off in the last few years after COVID because, you know, the grant dollars that came in to the states to support people during COVID went away.
I'd imagine you hear this often, but the question comes up obviously about healthcare costs, and I'm wondering how requiring insurers to cover the services of community health workers, how that would affect healthcare costs in general in the state.
Well, it's true. That is the biggest criticism, but you have to look at it on the other end and the savings that occur because someone's getting the help that they need. So there are many studies that have been done over time that show that the return on investment of community health workers far outweighs what we pay them.
How is the insurance industry responding?
So, Senator DeMario and Rep. Tansey have been meeting with representatives from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and they recognize the value of community health workers and have been open to trying to figure out how to make this work.
The companion bills are still in committee in both the House and Senate. How are you feeling right now about the chances this will pass, considering also we're coming up near the end of this session?
I don't know. You know, so there are people on the committee that are supportive. There are others that don't know enough yet to decide. And so it's currently stuck, I would say.
If it passes, whether this year or at some point in the future, will it solve all the challenges of paying for community health workers?
It won't. Okay. So community health workers play vital roles in lots of different organizations. And in other places, in other states, sometimes they're affiliated with senior citizen centers and with police departments. And so in a setting that is not set up to do billing through health insurance, how do you get those services paid for? One of the things that I think is unique about the role of community health workers is that they not only help navigate the health system, but they're also in tune with their community. And as they work with patients, they're able to identify systems issues and community problems that then in their role as community health workers, they're trained to, okay, how can we address this problem? You know, whether it be discrimination or it be some misunderstanding at some local office where people are going for help, that wouldn't be something that would be billable to insurance companies. So how do you get those hours spent working on those really important issues?
You're the coordinator for the Washington County Coalition for Children. I just wanted to know, can you tell us about the organization's partnership with the Narragansett school system, and how might this legislation impact that program?
Yes, that's why we got into this, right? So we learned about a novel program that used community health workers in schools to help facilitate telebehavioral health services. Oftentimes, children and youth have barriers receiving mental health services because there aren't enough providers out there in our state. The thing is, they often have availability during the school day. And so this model that we learned about in Massachusetts uses a community health worker that is that bridge between the school, the pediatrician, the behavioral health provider, and the parents to allow that student to have an appointment during the school day. In Massachusetts, where this program functions really well, the community health worker is able to bill Medicaid for some of their services, and that helps make that position sustainable. We were able to pilot this program with grant funds from the Van Buren Charitable Foundation. But without being able to bill private insurers as well, we will have a very difficult time continuing this program after our funding ends at the end of next school year.
Susan Orban, Board Director of the Washington County Coalition for Children. I really appreciate the time, Susan. Thanks so much for the insight.
You're so welcome. Thank you for asking.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. Back in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s in Providence, Leo's Bar was an institution and a pioneer in the city's jewelry district, known for its support of local artists and its eclectic clientele, late hours, and great food. And the man behind it all was John Rector. The Public Radio Daily editor, Marie Valindo, has this remembrance of John and Leo's Bar.
John passed away recently at the age of 75. I never got to meet him, but I knew a little bit about Leo's. And when I heard the news, I started asking around to see who might want to talk with us about John and the bar. And people came out of the woodwork. So many people wanted to share their memories about John and that time and place. Now we bring you but a slice of what they all had to say about John Rector and Leo's.
It was the first restaurant, the first business really in the jewelry district that led to the revivification of that district. It was kind of a gritty manufacturing part of the city, even though the manufacturing was dying.
There's a couple of things that are striking to you when you first walked in. Number one was the absolutely gorgeous mahogany bar. Probably could fit 25 people, 25 stools. Shiny brass fixtures with a really old mirror. So it had a real old feel to it.
John had this instinctive style of quality and the arts, and he didn't decorate the place. There was no specific style about Leo's. It was as eclectic as the people. It was a place where food, art, lawmakers, politicians, lawbreakers, all got together and enjoyed themselves and had a mutual respect for one another.
You also had whoever was governor was at the time would be in there, whether it was Ed DePreet or Bruce Sundland, they'd be in there with their entourage. Buddy Cianci was notorious for coming in 10 minutes before the kitchen closed at midnight on a Friday with his entourage. So there'd be, you know, 10 or 15 people coming in to order, you know, 10 minutes before you close the kitchen down. And it was just like, okay, that's just the way it was.
Buddy Cianci was a regular. while I was bartending behind the bar bartending, and then I look over and then there's Buddy sort of a few feet down from me, like refreshing his drink with a soda gun behind the bar. I say, okay, Buddy, this is your town, so I guess I can't really complain.
I'm just recalling in 1978 when the great blizzard hit, because of the proximity of the restaurant in a factory district where there were a lot of buildings with lots of employees, John opened up his business for the National Guard to bring in frozen foods to feed the people that were trapped in the buildings. So he wasn't making money on every dish for this. This was like just the sense of community he had, responsibility to help.
One of the stories that I hear all the time still, and this is 31 years after Leo's closed, is how many people met their spouse or their significant other at Leo's, because it was a safe place for anybody to go. Women would go there alone and feel completely comfortable. Everyone protected everybody else.
If anybody did become unruly or needed to be gotten out of the place, it was just this communication between people at the bar, patrons, and those of us that were in the kitchen and stuff. You know, this person would be pointed out, and the customers, the patrons, we would just take care of that person. Just like, nope, it's time to go. And you would just do it with as little fanfare as possible.
And by the time the restaurant closed in 94, they were coming in with their spouse that they met at the restaurant with the children that they now had. So it went from a place to go on a Friday night to see who you could meet to people coming in on a Sunday evening to get a decent meal with their children.
If I had to just say one thing about my experience at Leo's, was that John Rector created an environment where people felt seen and heard and respected and affirmed, no matter who you were. You would walk into Leo's and it was like walking into your family living room. I mean, you just always knew someone. I still have friends that I met and became really friendly with back 30 years ago.
I just remember John that was always very accepting of me personally and very kind to the people around him. If you had a struggle, he looked at you intently as you spoke of it and was just a caring person and socially was very dynamic to run that restaurant and have the amount of friends that he did. He just commanded a lot of love and respect.
His wit and his intellect really were just like sharp on. He could just like banter with anybody and just would always have something to add to any conversation with anybody that was in there. So it was just always fun to just like banter with John because you were always going to get a joke a day out of it.
Well, some people took advantage of him because he would always give anybody two or three chances, you know, if they made mistakes or stole something or was a non-show for work, whatever, things that most employers would not put up with for one second. He always gave people more chances.
I mean, he was my sidekick, and we'd always say that we were five footers because we were always 5 feet apart. And we just did things together, and we trusted each other, knew that the other one had the other one's back. And it was just, I think, trust and loyalty. And John's kindness and just a gentle guy.
For a lot of us, it was just a place that in your early professional years that people look back with, that look back upon with just a lot of great, great vibes and just wonderful memories that all of us had of both John and Leo's. And, you know, it's always trite sometimes to say, well, it's the end of an era, but with John now gone, that might be trite, but it's also true.
Those were the voices of Teresa Level, Linda Edmondson, John Burt, Donna Burt, Anne-Marie Harrington, Scott McKay, and Dan Gosch, talking about their memories of the iconic Providence bar, Leo's, and the man who ran it, John Rector. John passed away recently at the age of 75. There's a birthday celebration of his life at the Met in Pawtucket on Saturday, May 17th from 2 to 5 p.m., including live music and an AV show. You can find more episodes of Artscape at thepublicsradio.org/arts, as well as a longer version of this story featuring photos of John and Leo's. For The Publix Radio, I'm Mareva Lindo.
Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me now to share a few tips on what to do this week. Hey, James, what do you have?
Well, let's start with AS220 Youth, who are presenting Future Worlds 9 this weekend. It's a multi-layered Afrofuturist hip-hop theater production produced and performed by some of Providence's most talented young artists. The theme this year is home. Where do you come from? Who do you belong to? How do you find your way back after being lost for so long? That's Future Worlds 9, Friday and Saturday at 6 p.m. at the AS220 Black Box Theater. On Saturday, you can see Fusik Rossoni in Tiverton. That's John Fusik and Marianne Rossoni, two legends of the Rhode Island folk music world. They'll be playing together at the Four Corners Arts Center in Tiverton Saturday at 7 p.m. And on Sunday, there's a free concert in Newport featuring the Rasa String Quartet, along with percussionist Brian Shankar Adler. They'll play a few traditional pieces, as well as tangos from Astor Piazzolla, as well as original compositions for string quartet and percussion. That's at Newport Craft Brewing on Sunday at 2:30 p.m.
Always a lot of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Publix Radio. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our editor this week is Alex Nunes. Our chief content officer is Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening.